Brothers and sisters, neighbors, this is Resistance Radio on enlightenedradio.org, being heard here in the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia, all over the United States, and across both oceans. It's great to have you with us this morning. Very important day, the morning after the Rumps 45s. Okay, in case you don't understand the code, Trump's wag the dog speech last night, where he is, and we're going to talk in these next few minutes a little bit at length with my brother and my leader and my friend, John Case.
Woof, woof.
Hey, the founder, CEO, chairman of the board of Enlightened Radio, John Case, here at the Red Caboose.
Some have referred to the board as a plank.
Right. Well, a board is a plank. but we're going to, John and I are going to talk about this question of, is Trump getting back to his lowest common denominator? Is he getting back to not just his base, but the core of his base? And what does that mean? And what will he do to get there if that's where he's headed? So we'll have a few minutes to discuss that question, I think.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. I think the question was kind of asked by the Post was reporting this morning that the speakers that introduced Trump,
yes,
at the rally all appealed to let's unite, let's don't divide. The president was mischaracterized in his real response, real feelings about the Charlottesville thing and other matters. And so let's all try to come together. And they had the Reverend Franklin Graham there. And,
oh, my Lord.
And Dr. King's daughter, what is it? Which one of her name? Alvita?
No, Alvita. That's not her daughter. That's her niece.
Okay.
Not a member of the nuclear family here. Okay. Very big distinction.
Okay. I knew I was stepping on sacred ground there. I shouldn't. Because I didn't know. I really wasn't sure. So, but nonetheless. Okay. So, nonetheless, all of whom appealed for, you know, don't divide the country along race and other things. And then comes Trump. And the unity message has ended. And it's now time for let's insult some more people over and over again.
And John, so he got his butt kicked. I mean, let's just say the truth as it is. This resistance, part of which has been very, very, very visible, but an even larger part of this has been under the radar screen. It has been people who are working every day, don't have the time to go to the meetings, go to the mobilizations until it's all on the line.
Yeah.
And that's when 50,000 patriotic Americans hit the streets of Boston to crush Trump's Nazi vanguard, his KKK vanguard. They got their little, cowardly, racist, hateful asses kicked between Charlottesville and now. As a reaction to Charlottesville, a growing anger amongst the people of the United States through the ass whooping in Boston, and now continuing today.
Well, I understand there was it would be nice if we could get some numbers on the crowds both in the arena and outside there in Arizona, but do we have any numbers on that yet?
I haven't seen any.
We'll have to. We're avidly watching our teletype here. Any minute to come in. Okay, here in the Red Caboose in Bolivar. Actually, my cat is looking at me in a manner that says that he knows, but he can't seem to communicate. So anyway,
he was just looking at me that way, John.
I know.
You know. That's John's cat, Wally.
Yeah, who's inhabiting part of the caboose. Anyway, so there we go. Well, I don't know what to say to you. I think the fascist movement here, I'm going to just call it that because I can't. That's what we're down to. I'm not going to start using alt-right and all. I mean,
no, please don't. No.
The whole thing, you know. It's just.
Alt-right is a lie that we have consumed.
And I know that this movement is a lot bigger, you know. I mean, for example, the Republicans have been saying, look, we're not just the KKK and the Nazis. Except when you start telling us what you really want to do to the American people, then the question of differences becomes a bit academic, and so the Nazis and the KKK feel fine coming out of the network. Hey, they know you're really
on their side.
They know that you also fear becoming a white minority.
Right.
And they know that
and losing privilege.
The racial dialogue, they understand the racial dialogue perfectly, and they have sympathies, they don't want to lose their culture. And of course they're also raising money from, very very wealthy people, that have interests to protect.
Absolutely.
And don't care how you do it. They don't plan on you making your promises of improved public works be paid for at their expense. Okay, you can have your people pay for them if you want them.
They're all for it. You know, John, I bet you didn't know this.
What?
Those guys you're just talking about are all for the unity of the working class. Did you know that? I bet you didn't know.
I didn't.
They just want to make sure it's unified in their workplaces at a below living wage,
preferably in a uniform.
A uniform that the workers themselves buy.
I'm sorry. The modern economies that are developing here, guys, you can't put it in uniforms. Go try to put a bunch of programmers in uniforms.
Right.
You know what they'll do? The next day, they'll come to work as an Elvis impersonator. And you...
Thank you.
And
you thank you very much, boss. Thank you very much.
I got a really big problem.
A little song goes something like this.
Here comes our call. Good morning. You're on the air. Can you hear me okay?
I sure can.
Okay. Well, that sounds like David Eckstein. What's up, Big Eck?
How are you, man? I'm doing great.
This is Stuart. This is Stuart, and the other one's John, David.
Hi. Hi, David. This is John Case.
Good morning, John.
Yeah, you're on enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting from the Red Caboose, Bolivar, West Virginia.
And ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors, sisters and brothers, let me introduce David Eckstein right here on the Rock of Appalachia. David Eckstein started his career in the labor movement as a dock man for Kroger Groceries in Cincinnati, or just outside Cincinnati, and where he moved freight from truck to truck, to be distributed at Kroger grocery stores in the Indiana, Ohio, and Kentucky areas. Where he distinguished himself as a rank and file leader, becoming a shop steward and working his way up the avenues of leadership in the Teamsters Union. He was a Teamster, and deciding for a progressive direction in his life and his union, and joined the TDU, the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, became active in John Kerry's historic groundbreaking campaign, the first really, truly, deeply progressive campaign in this stage of the labor movement, historical stage of the labor movement.
Almost certainly, as far as one knows or can tell.
And that was an interesting interruption. But David became national field director for the Teamsters in the Ron Kerry administration. Then he came to the AFL-CIO and worked his way up in the organizing department with me to deputy assistant organizing director and regional organizing coordinator for the Midwest in the AFL-CIO. So he's had a great campaign, lots of victories, lots of struggles, lots of fights, lots of years. A real trade unionist, a progressive trade unionist, who understands everything that we have to do in this labor movement. And thank you, David Eckstein, for being on Resistance Radio, coming at you from Bolivar/Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia. How are you this morning, David?
Well, I'm doing great. I'd like to thank you and John for having me on this morning. You know, I was yesterday, I was going through a bunch of my boxes of old national campaign drives that we did.
Yeah.
Field campaigns, and it was exciting, and it was sad, too, knowing that it's all history now. I had the privilege over the years of being involved in some really big struggles in the labor movement, and I thank God for that, and I thank Ron Carey for that mainly, because he's the one that had faith enough in me to put me in those positions.
Yep.
And then all the other people, by the way, the good, talented field staff that we had, and labor leaders around the country that got involved in those struggles. And I actually had almost forgot in my mind how many of them we did do over that 2-3 year period. I mean, we did a lot of big struggles.
Yes, y'all did at the Teamsters. You certainly did. And I had the privilege and honor of being deeply involved in about three of them. I was deeply involved in UPS because I was president of the Atlanta AFL-CIO, and UPS's headquarters was Atlanta, so we had to wage quite a war on the in their backyard. And I was heavily involved in the Pony Express strike, and then just after the leadership changed, I was involved in the overnight strike, heavily involved in the overnight strike. And that was quite a privilege, especially to work with you, David. Always a great inspiration and a great tactician and strategist, which you proved.
Yeah. I mean, those were good days, you know, and I wish we could have gone forward with that, because that same strategy worked on every single one of those campaigns. It wasn't rocket science, Stuart. It was just getting our members involved, training them. You know, we started those campaigns, each of them, a year in advance, doing town hall meetings with our members, doing surveys with our members.
Right, knocking on doors.
You know, when you've seen those strikes, especially at UPS, you never seen leadership on there, very seldom. You see Carrie on there now and then. But even our local officers, we kept them away from the cameras and had our members on there talking.
Oh, especially UPS. Oh, especially UPS. You all won UPS based on, it was the ultimate coalition strike, because it was sort of, you made it, you nationalized it, and made and created an interest of every worker, and you all went in that campaign, and that was... It was about way more than just, you know, making part-time work full-time. But that was what you waged the external struggle around. That was the issue that you identified for the public and for potential allies, what that strike was about. And then, and so, you know, really quickly, the rest of the labor movement got on board on the UPS strike. But by the time... You all settled on the 16th day, which I remember well. By the time you all settled, the broader American community saw that they had an interest in y'all winning that strike, which is a lesson that the current labor movement leadership needs to understand. You have to connect with people outside the institution. We're too small to win it by ourselves now. You have to have a broader base, and that's what you all understood at the Teamsters, and that's what you taught the rest of the labor movement, and that was what the broader labor movement understood for about 20 years, and it's no longer
apparent. Yeah, well, you know, Carrie had a deep belief and practiced it, that in... You can't win without membership, and you can't win without the community.
Right.
And everything that we did had to represent those two things. community membership.
Yep. Yep.
And engagement. And if you didn't have that, you'd wasting your breath going into a meeting with them because you didn't want to talk about it.
Right. I'll tell you. I'm going to drop an interesting, harmless bit of secret correspondence that I never would have admitted to during the UPS strike, but I feel free to admit now in light of this conversation. Before, and I'm guessing several months before, one of Carrie's top staff guys, not you, David, but someone close to your level, who I'd known for a couple decades, called me in a private conversation and said, Ron Carey is coming to Atlanta and he would like to engage in an activity that would resonate in the community and that people would see as representing the life, the society, the culture of Atlanta and what people feel best about Atlanta. And right there, you had the Teamsters leading in, you know, gearing up for the strike, beginning to escalate into the strike, wanting to establish a bond with the people of Atlanta that was deeper than just a brain bond or an intellectual bond, that was something akin to, you know, more spiritual bond. And that's pretty deep thinking several months before a strike.
Right.
So,
well, that's the way he worked on everything. I mean, he really made us dig in at least a year in advance. We had to start them projects, and start getting our members educated, start getting our members involved, and start doing actions, by the way. We do small actions. We was doing like one a month. We do a small action, and they get harder and harder each time.
Right. You're training the membership on militancy and escalation. You're recruiting the activists because you're offering the activists something they want to do. So you're bringing more people off the bench, so to speak, onto the playing field. You're beginning to build your power. And you're sending management.
Can you remember the whistles?
Yes, of course. The whistles and the clackers.
You know, that was an internal struggle, by the way, and most people don't know this.
Mm-hmm.
But Ron was a real practical guy, and some things he seen as childish. He would butt head with me and Rand Wilson.
Right.
And Ron, I never forget him calling me to his office. He said, "Dave, that'll never work. That's childish." You know? And then I went back to my office, and we had already ordered like 90,000 of these things. We were looking to order 90,000 more. Right? I thought, holy crap, brother, we're in deep doo-doo here. And but nevertheless, to make a long story short, it wasn't even 2 or 3 hours. He called them, had me come up to his office. He says, "Dave, you really think that whistle thing will work?" I said, "Yeah, I do." He says, "If you think it, we're going to do it." And then right after that, you know, we started telling our members, you know, get ready, these things are coming out. We had them disseminated, right. And it was real quick that UPS management sent Carey a real scathing letter saying, if those folks stop work and blow those whistles, we'll fire every one of them. Carey fired another letter back to him and said, "Well, I welcome you to do that, because we'll read every fucking one of those letters. Every grievance that you got, we'll grieve you to death." And they didn't do anything. I mean, the bottom line is we did it. We stuck to our guns. He stuck to his guns. And it was, all those things were important leading up to that deadline. You know?
Right. Well, and this discussion leads me into another discussion that I want to talk about. John and I were talking earlier this morning, and during a previous show, we were talking about how deep a hole Trump is in, and how it appears that he is digging for the core of his base, that he knows he's lost the majority of Americans. Finally, he knows that. Although he liked to kid, for months he liked to kid himself that he hadn't. But I think finally he understands that he's at his bottom line. He knows Mueller, the independent special prosecutor, special prosecutor, is closing the net around him and his family's, you know, Jared Kushner has already, the president, and his son-in-law, Kushner, have admitted publicly to felonies. There's a chance of being charged with with crimes after his presidency is ended. And so he's digging for his base and looking to maybe intimidate people on the other side, maybe create the illusion that the Republic could be upset in some way, that things obviously are messy now but could get messier. And so in light of what we're seeing, it really bothered me the other day to see the president of the AFL-CIO, just after Charlottesville, resigning from the president's manufacturing council, because I've long thought that the labor movement needed to be in the forefront of the resistance and the fight against Trump. And obviously, the labor movement, on some level, was trying to have a relationship that I didn't understand that you could have that would be in our interests at all. I mean, otherwise, I mean, if it weren't in our interests, why would Trump do it? Obviously, he's not a friend of the working person. What's your response to that, David?
Well, you know what? I think it was way late for Trump, and then for Trump's cut for dropping off that.
Right.
And then the statements that I seen yesterday, a couple more on the on Facebook and the internet, you know, where the two people from the labor movement that was on it admitted that they weren't invited to any functions, they weren't invited to any meetings. Well, that should tell you it's time to get out, right?
Right, exactly. That should tell you you're just window dressing at best.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, what do you think? You're going to take a person that's got a habitual problem, and you know, and then they named those CEOs like they were gods.
Right, exactly.
Individual prominent CEOs.
Oh, yeah.
Named them like they were gods. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
These folks snubbed you, didn't invite you to anything, yet you think you're going to change them.
Right.
I don't think so.
No. Trump is a fascist. It was clear to me a year ago that he was. I think it's clear, pretty much clear to most fair-minded people in the country that Trump has fascistic tendencies, is a fascist, loves authoritarianism, sees himself as an authoritarian leader, and wants more and more power and control, and is desperately trying to get it. But, David, I think here's the question I want to spend some time talking about today, is what would you and I do if we again had significant levels of leadership in the labor movement? What would be the course we would take against Trump? And, you know, not only do we have the experience that we had in our individual unions, but also in the AFL-CIO and with labor councils and state feds. And clearly, you know, both you and I, David, have for a long time had to and wanted to relate to the broader left as active allies of the struggles we were involved in. So, you know, when I do, and so I'm going to say a couple things, David, so you can kind of get the wheels of your mind going around this question of what would we do if we had leadership positions now. As I'm working with our local resistance here in the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia, I've been very, very positively supportive of their agenda, because I think the folks who are helping the folks nationally, the folks in Washington who are helping local folks figure this out and how to be most effective, have laid out a pretty good broad strategy. A lot of meetings with congressional staff, in West Virginia's case, a lot of meetings with the staff of Senator Capito during the healthcare fight, a lot of ways of engaging her, creative ways of engaging her and her staff. I mean, we did these photographs and put them inside frames that laid out the issue. I have a pre-existing condition, for instance. My photograph was delivered inside a frame that said that, because I have asthma and a little bit of heart disease. So that was creative, and another several hundred, little messages from constituents. We would do letter signing parties where people would come and have a cup of coffee. We did one at Maria's. People would come and have a Maria's Taqueria in Shepherdstown, and people would come and get a burrito and sign their name to a letter, or write a handwrite a letter. We also did actions. During the fight over health care to repeal Obamacare, when arguably the two most important senators in the country were the West Virginia senators, Shelley Moore Capito, a Republican, and Manchin, a Democrat. Then when it came down to the votes of the women, essentially, in the Senate, it came down to Capito. And we were in front of her office with a large crowd or a small group, something every day, 5 days a week. We found an excuse to go to her office, whether it was doing a sine wave with cars passing by, or doing a rally at her office, or delivering letters, petitions, whatever it was. Those are all things that already established AFL-CIO local central labor councils know how to do, have done it millions of times. I did it as the president of a labor council, and then I asked labor councils to do it when I became organizing director of the national AFL-CIO. Those are all things labor council, state feds can do and are comfortable doing. Don't even ask them to get outside their comfort zone. And easy and simple to do. Every labor council has a group of activists that will do something publicly for no more than a phone call. All you have to do is ask them. And so, knowing how the AFL-CIO and the broader labor movement are set up to be part of the resistance to the Trump agenda, and knowing that that instrument, that tool was left on the bench, that team was not put on the field, was when I saw it mobilized so many times, when I mobilized it so many times, was concerning, David. It was very concerning to me.
Yeah, well, it was me too. I mean, it was almost like we were gone, like we were out for lunch. Nothing was happening, and it really is a matter of education and training.
Yeah, so go
people in the streets.
So David, you know, take the question and run with it. I mean, what do you think we should have been doing, and how could we have done it? And go ahead.
Well, the first thing is, I mean, it has to start on the top has to be involved, right? I mean, they have to want it to be able to move it down to the membership.
Absolutely.
And without that, it can't happen.
Leadership, not only matters, leadership is crucial. Absolutely.
Yeah, so national leadership has to get off behind their desk, get out and do house calls on these local officers, especially the big ones, moving from the biggest locals down in their unions. They need to send their executive councils and their executive boards and their leadership out to these locals and sit and have town hall meetings with them and one-on-ones.
And coffees.
And then move it down to the membership and do meetings with open memberships and start engaging them in their shops and so on. And then start doing small events that's easy. Because if you do something easy, then you next time you can do something a little bit harder.
That's right.
That's right.
And everything we can do that
mechanism, like you said, our central labor councils and our state feds are set up for that, but we're not utilizing them.
Right. And let me just say this, because I think it's part of the undercurrent here. All of those require leadership. David is right. As you go down the ladder, each successive leader has to provide leadership in his area amongst his or her constituents. So the president to the executive council, the executive council to their regions and districts, the regions and districts to the large locals, down to the smaller locals, down to the general membership. Those are all steps of leadership. David, do you have other? I'm sorry. Go ahead and talk about now. Let's talk about mobilizations. Let's talk about bringing people out in numbers.
And to be able to get people out in numbers, of course, it has to have gotten down to the floor, down to the membership on the shop floor. We have to be able to get commitments from leadership to be able to get commitments from their membership to move things and to have use the local as a clearinghouse, right?
Right.
But the stuff's got to get down on the shop floor, and then you got to get commitments from them.
Right.
And you have to have people committed to phone banking their coworkers and phone banking their fellow members of their locals and so on. And once that starts happening, and if you can get somebody to say, you can count on me to be there, you can count on them to be there.
Right.
Hey, David, Stuart, can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
So I'm anticipating, and I hope this is true, that we're going to see some calls for national mobilizations to focus the anti-Trump resistance. I'm hoping that those mobilizations take place also before the 2018 congressional election. As an example, if we were going to mobilize memberships to participate in either both the mobilization and get out the vote, get oriented on the vote, what would be the issues and what would be your first take on the first pitch to these memberships as to why they need to wake up and, despite all kinds of other problems in their life, pay attention to this?
Why don't you start, David, and then I'll come in behind you.
Well, I mean, the first thing that always is interesting to the membership is their contracts.
Yep.
And the slipping of wages and working conditions and the shrinkage of our members overall and so on. Those kind of things are what members care about.
So that comes down to a question of power in the bargaining relationship. I mean, when you're talking about organizing and growth, you're essentially talking about power in the bargaining relationship, right, David?
That's exactly right.
So there, but what about the people that say, oh, our bargaining relationship, if we go with these losers, the liberals and the environmentalists out in the street, you know, that we got a better deal if we can try to make a deal with the other side. I mean, the you know, Trump or join one of his commissions, et cetera, like that.
Well, there.
What about that debate?
I mean, that is, I mean, that's a, that's sort of the core of what we're talking about this morning. Because obviously, both sort of under the radar screen and publicly, people around Trumka and Trumka himself have been making that argument since Trump was elected. And, you know, that was the argument that was made in terms of getting an infrastructure program. That was the argument that was made in terms of natural gas pipelines. And that is essentially the argument that was made by the president of the AFL-CIO, Trumka, when he pulled out of the Manufacturing Council. We were here to, you know, create a climate where more people could have unions, blah, 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 blah. The problem is that when you're dealing with a fascist like Trump, that's exactly what he doesn't want to have happen. So you're, when you deal with people like Donald Trump in good faith, you're going to get screwed every time. If you don't have the power to enforce the deal, he's going to screw you on the deal. I mean, that's his whole history. Everybody who knows anything about Trump, and I cannot believe the National Labor Movement, with as many brilliant staff people and researchers as they have, don't know everything there is to know about Donald Trump. I would have put on President Sweeney's desk a book about Donald Trump had he emerged in 2008. I talk to John Sweeney about George Bush every day when George Bush was president, because, you know, we had a responsibility to try to grow the labor movement. We were not in hunkered down area. We were confronting challenges. We sort of had a view of how to expand the debate and drive the debate and drive wedges in our opposition. That's why we were able to grow the labor movement for the first time in a generation in 2007 and 2008. That requires leadership, and it requires the ability and the commitment to do hard things.
You know, David, though, just mentioned, you know, this first thought was the members are concerned about the wages, benefits, and jobs. This is part of my question about whether or not, for example, there was a Democratic Party official, I believe, in Cleveland, the head of the party, Democratic Party, who kept sending letters to the Clinton campaign saying, we got people here in our party members in certain districts that have got a lot bigger problems, they say, than the bathroom debate in North Carolina. And,
exactly.
There has to be some paying attention here going on.
Right.
And I think that, you know, there's, and it's the same thing I think about, you know, about the debates here in the Eastern Panhandle or across West Virginia about natural gas. Okay, everybody, the environmentalists, they want to get rid of it. They don't care about anything else. They want to get rid of it. And then they say, it's currently paying 5-7 something like 7% of the state budget. Well, where's that money going to be replaced with? You know, as if that's an unimportant question. Okay, but it's not an unimportant question, you know. And what's going to happen to, you say, those pipeline workers or those gas jobs, you know, they're just temporary jobs. Well, I mean, what other kind of job is there in construction? I mean, frankly, anymore, everything's in gigs these days. And so you're going to tell everybody, fall on their swords, and then what? You know, I mean, that part, I think there's a tension there that, that I sort of come down on the side of the people, like the workers that are end up being victimized, because I really do believe if you want to have progressive change in technology, or you want to respect somebody's rights, and you don't want to cross some sacred ground with a pipeline or whatever, that if it's gonna, you got to pay the guys. You know, you got to pay the losers in these situations. Otherwise, everybody's at war over crumbs, it seems to me, and not focusing on their what they have in common. I don't know. You have any thoughts on that? It bugs me sometimes. But
David, you can go ahead. I don't mean to rant. Sorry.
But I get you. You know, sometimes labor is torn between these issues, you know, especially on that pipeline across the reservation and sacred ground. How does labor preserve jobs? And that same goes with coal, by the way.
Sure.
How do you preserve jobs and still keep our members working? I don't know that I have a real good answer.
There's no immediate answer. There's no immediate answer. These are... I think the answer to these questions come up on a case-by-case basis. I mean, you can have...
And it can't be just, hey, you shut that down. You know, we used to sit across the table when I was at the Teamsters with the environmentalists, and we would talk about our chemical plants and this and that.
Right.
Well, their position was always shut it down, we don't care.
Right.
Well, we do care. We got 3,000 members in that plant.
Well, that's right. Yeah, exactly.
And those people don't have another third. Sorry,
the same thing that you're saying, John. We used to say to them. So, what's your opinion of how do we keep our members' jobs here, and clean the environment up, but yet both sides can be happy here?
Right.
Well, they never had an answer either, other than shut it down. Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, then you just you can't you're stuck in the mud at that point. It seems to me in a lot of situations.
Right.
You know, my wife, she's the professional economist, and she says it's a simple problem in economics. You pay the loser. You know, and you pay them a lot. All right. In other words, you pay them enough so
that it works. Whole.
You make them whole.
Right.
I'm sorry, your mining job is gone. But guess what? You get 5 years of income and a free college education.
Right.
Your kids all get to college and health care for the rest of your life or something like that. I mean, you pay somebody who's going to lose, right? And then they get a chance to become winners again. I guess that's what the theory of capitalism was supposed to achieve. At some point, right?
Well,
I don't know whether it has, but
we're beyond that development.
I guess we're beyond that now. I'm sorry, you know.
David and I, we've been engaged in this question of what we should be doing vis-a-vis Donald Trump, and we're not just poking at the movement we came out of and both love very dearly, more than we love our own lives, because we certainly both risked our own lives many times for that movement. So it's not just we're throwing rocks at the folks who are a little bit younger than us. It is that the labor movement has made a collective decision, and based on leadership, to leave the most effective tools in combating this resistance and combating this president sitting on the bench. And that's not good for the labor movement. It's not good for our country. The truth of the matter is that democracy does not exist in the absence of a number of different pillars of democracy. One is the free press. One is the separation of the government from forms of worship and beliefs in worship, so the separation of church and state. That is a incredible pillar for democracy. So you have the free press, that you have a diverse government, whereby I mean power is distributed across a base rather than rest in a single individual. You have to have free education, and you have to have a workers' movement, whether you call it a union, whether you call it a federation, whether you call it a group of unions. You have to have a powerful organization and institution of worker power as the offset, the counter to corporate power. And obviously, our labor movement in America has lost too much ground. And we, for good reasons, but also for bad reasons, we have lost, a lot of our effectiveness in representing workers, speaking for workers, and standing up for workers. And it's that, it's not personal peak, our personal payback, it's that big question of power that has driven this conversation in these last 2 weeks about the role of the labor movement vis-a-vis Donald Trump. It's a very, very important question.
Stuart, I think not everybody, that would be a very unfair, untrue statement. There's a lot of key labor leaders right now.
Absolutely.
They don't want our members out in the street.
Yeah.
And don't know how to get them out in the street. And don't, you know, what we've lost in labor from the 30s and 40s, if you look back in Minnesota and Chicago and Detroit and places where Reuther and John L. Lewis, and even clear up into Cary in 97 with the Beakers, what we've lost is we have not been able, or maybe it's because we just refuse to, we're not getting our members out in the street. Our members love that stuff.
Yeah.
They love to kick back.
Right.
And they love to be able to get out and step high.
Right.
And win things. And if we're not helping them win, we're beating them down.
Right. Well, that's a very good point, David. That's a very, very good point. I mean, we look for virtuous cycles. And one of the virtuous cycles that is most important in movement politics and movement organizing, movement building, and in the labor movement is the role of your rank and file. The more your rank and file is invested in a fight, the more you're likely to win. And also, the more you're likely to turn on your rank and file and to give them positive feedback. That then increases the involvement in the rank and file in the next fight and the next fight, and it grows. It is a virtuous circle. Your success breeds more success, and it's very important.
Listen, Stuart, I had a labor leader one time inside the Teamsters, by the way, when we were doing all these contract campaigns. It was really around the Budweiser campaign on that.
Uh-huh. Right.
He said, well, what if we get these people all psyched up, our members? He called them these people.
Right.
And he said, if we get these people all psyched up, what if we can't bring them back down? I said, well, let's
work. That ain't a problem, buddy.
Yeah. How do we get them back down? I said, that is a crazy statement. Our members are smart people, and they know what's right, but they also want to fight, and they want to win. And we can help them do that by empowering them to give them what they need to go out. And that issue, by the way, that I was talking about, is, I don't know if you remember, but during the Super Bowl in San Diego that year, we went out there and wreaked havoc on the Super Bowl. We put whistles in there, too, by the way. They couldn't even do the halftime show right.
Because
we put them in kids' hands, and they were afraid to take them away from the kids. They would have took them from the adults and marched them out, but we gave the kids the whistles.
You know,
nevertheless, this guy says, how do we get these people back down? We get them all excited about their contract. Well, that's a huge problem with leadership, if that's how they feel.
When I was in the UE, and of course we had a very democratic union in Muscat, but one of the things I noticed was that the companies play a role in undermining the democracy of a union organization, and they do so both for vile as well as just ordinary business reasons, and the main business reason is that they don't like to do business with more than one person.
Right.
You know? And they want consistency. And so they will actually...
And they want somebody to buy off.
Well, but in, well, exactly. So in times of lesser conflict, they'll ask, what can we do to build up the reputation of this guy or this woman, right, who's an officer and who's going to play cards with us, okay? And a partner at various things, right? Or at least right. Or at least a known component. We know what we can get him to do or can't right. do, that kind of thing. And, you know, there is a certain validity to that in ordinary day-to-day operations in a business, right? I mean, does everybody want to be on strike every day? No. Now, when you get into, the problem was those kind of people end up sometimes being, they fear that the sort of super, a more democratic orientation or a more rank and file orientation will then makes them more accountable to the membership and less accountable to the employer, you know. And that creates a change in the whole, all the relationships. And they'll resist that in times. I mean, I've seen that happen in, you know, very democratic locals. But I've seen deals made with the company that, hey, we'll let this guy win an arbitration, so he's a hero. I've seen that
You're
happen.
Right, John,
I've seen that happen.
By the way, I lived that at the Teamsters, at those grievance panels in Chicago, my friend.
On the other hand, you know, I mean, it's true that ending a strike is a lot easier than starting one. That's true. You know, yeah, you get in a big showdown, and it does take skill. It does take experience and skill and people who understand these things to sometimes keep them from unraveling into a disaster. Right. I mean, that there is some truth to that. But still, okay, that's the whole point, right, of the in my view, of the class struggle in some respects, is that people learn to take control of their destiny, and they learn about what it's like to wield some power.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's right. What a democracy is really about.
And you have to be willing and able to continue to exercise leadership. You know, it's a very, you know, sort of patient way of doing business. You have to explain why we're going to do this, or why you think we should do this, and let's have a conversation about it, and what do you think, and let me hear you out, let me hear your concerns, and let me hear where you're coming from, let me respond to that, and then, you know, walk that through a certain core group so that everybody is on the same page, not just tactically, but strategically. And not just strategically, but in terms of values. So what is this particular way of going? What is the value that it rests on? Well, we know that this will help build our membership. And the value that this rests on is the value of being effective and powerful, which always has to be reinforced because, you know, Americans don't like conflict. And Americans are not necessarily comfortable with the concept of power. And so you have to explain over and over and over again. We're talking about power for you. We're talking about power at the level democracy is built on. That is your dreams, your desires, your hopes for your children and your family and your future comfort and security. And, you know, that has to be expressed and expressed over and over again. And a guy like Donald Trump is absolutely opposed to that. He wants just the opposite. He is trying to strip our democracy of all power and assume as much control as he possibly can. And that's why he was in Arizona last night. That's why he wants to power up and fire up this base. That's why he tries to undermine the free press. That's why he talks about fake news all the time. That's why ultimately he wants to destroy the American labor movement. You know, that's why he, you know, has challenged the courts and minimized the Congress. That's why he's in a fight with McConnell, who's hardly any better than he is, but that's where all that comes from.
Yeah, I watched that last night. It was sad. I mean, how people can buy into all that stuff. And, you know, he just screws around and reading that letter. It took him forever to read those letters to interject every sentence. And then it was just, and the stuff that he said originally, by the way, in Charlottesville was not even in them papers, by the way.
When I'm sure. I'm sure.
Yeah, well, you know, when he's the statement of there's people are guilty on both sides and all that, right? He didn't say that last night. That's what inflamed people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Both sides didn't run over that girl.
Right, right. No, that's right. Well, we're going to have to begin to wrap this up, David Eckstein. Once again, we are very grateful for your appearance on the show today, David. You are a great friend of the show, a great friend of the network of this radio station, and a wonderful friend of mine. And as I always tell you when I get ready to say goodbye, go back and tell your lovely wife, Pam, that she is finally fed up with your sorry ass and to have her call me.
I'll do that. I'll tell her. So Stuart and John, I really appreciate I love getting on here chatting with y'all. You know, like all of us old lefties,
yeah.
Funny.
Well, come and come to West Virginia, and we'll introduce you to the studio in the red caboose. Okay,
yeah.
And
there you go,
Jay, right, buddy. Dave, you're a great guy, and I sure appreciate you. I appreciate all you've done for me these last 20, 30 years. You be well,
I love
okay?
You,
love you too. We'll talk soon, okay?
Take care, man.
See ya.
All right. Bye.
What the inimitable organizer, David Eckstein, is pure. A progressive and a lefty as you could find, as pure a progressive trade unionist you could find. I never had to check myself which way was Eckstein on on this question.
Wonderful
or that
guy.
Question.
Wonderful guy. Yeah.
And, you know, it's like my friend Chris Christopherson, and I say that somewhat truthfully, my acquaintance Chris Christopherson said about Johnny Cash, so I say it about David Eckstein. He's like the North Star. You can set your direction by it.
That's right, man. All right, are we all set?
Yeah. Well, we got
you got a minute to go.
Yeah, here. I got a minute. Maybe I'm going to say this, and maybe you
got
can put
2 minutes.
Maybe you can put on a little music when I get done.
Oh, sure.
Please tune in again next Wednesday for Resistance Radio right here on EnlightenRadio.org in the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia, the Rock of Appalachia.